Hello, Patrick Cox here with the World in Words from the Old Country.
This little shanty's a romance. Tells how a sailor took a chance. He bought a boat for almost double its worth. Then gave his bird a double berth. She got a double bunk.
Do people really speak like that in the place I grew up? Well, today we're going to hear a lot of different versions of British English. How British English sounded at the time of World War I. How it might have sounded had the Saxons won the Battle of Hastings in 1066. How some banks and wine merchants are selling it now. And how some American Anglophiles mimic it. Here's a soupçon.
Lovely, darling, lovely.
I got a double bunk, double trouble bunk. I really had a hunk of trouble in that bunk.
She'd rather leave her bones to dear old Davy Jones.
Much better to have sunk than share that double bunk.
The World in Words podcast and the World Radio Programme are both produced here in Boston by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International and WGBH. The World, the big show, is on more than 280 public radio stations in the United States. You can also listen online at theworld.org. You can also check out our other podcasts there. Go to theworld.org/podcasts. I post notes on this podcast at theworld.org/language and also at patrickcox.wordpress.com. There's a World in Words group page on Facebook. I'm also on Twitter. My handle is Patrick Cox, PatrickCox. Okay, so it's all British English all the time for today's pod. And I'm saving the best for last today. Americans on Britishisms and Cockney rhyming slang. And first up, we have a story on a remarkable archive of British dialects. And it's remarkable because of the circumstances under which it was all recorded. We did this on the big show. And question and answer wise, the shoe is very much on the other foot. I'm answering the questions, and the big show's Marco Werman is asking them. Here's Marco.
Here at The World, we record people's voices every day. And there have been times when we've recorded people under some pretty strange circumstances. But Patrick Cox, host of our podcast, The World in Words, you're here to tell us about an audio archive that was recorded in prisoner of war camps in Germany during World War I.
Yes, the British Library has just acquired a digital recording of this archive. It had been languishing in relative obscurity in Berlin. And the recordings were made by a German linguist called Wilhelm Dugan. And it was in 1916. It was right in the middle of World War I. He got permission to visit a couple of POW camps that were full of British soldiers. He recorded them. He recorded hundreds of voices. And as a result, this is now considered the earliest collection of English dialect recordings in the world.
So how did this Mr. Dugan do this? Because, I mean, earliest recordings, they didn't really have portable tape recorders for sure. What was he recording on?
Well, he was recording on shellac discs, which came pretty expensively. And you can hear an awful lot of the record scratch in the few samples that have been released so far. Here's one of them.
There was a man who had two sons. The youngest of them said to his father, "Give me that part of your thing that belongs to me."
That's the voice of a prisoner originally from Macclesfield in the north of England, and he's reading from the Bible, the parable of the prodigal son. And Wilhelm Dugan, he wanted to have his prisoners read the same text so he could note the change in the dialect.
And as we know, the United Kingdom has lots of different dialects, so he must have heard a lot of different sounds.
Absolutely, including some that no longer exist. Here's another prisoner from Bletchington, which is near Oxford.
"There were a man as had two sons. The younger on him said to his father, 'Gi that part of your goods that belong to I.'"
Now, if you had someone from that part of Britain speak today, they wouldn't sound anything like as rural as that.
Right.
They'd sound vaguely Southern English. And that's what's so unique about this archive. It captured the dialects of ordinary people at a time when ordinary people just simply weren't being recorded. So Dugan was a real pioneer in anthropological linguistics.
And he recorded voices, of course, from all over what was then the British Empire. Will descendants of these POWs be able to now identify these voices?
In many cases, yes, because the names of the speakers were documented. So therefore, you could cross-reference that with British Army records.
So Patrick, tell us what the most compelling recording you heard in this archive has been.
Well, this has to be a Scotsman. His name is George Campbell, and he's singing a famous old Scottish song called "The Bonnie Banks of Loch Lomond."
Money, happy day on the bonnie-
Marco sounds like he was almost enjoying himself, despite where he was.
Yeah, I mean, I would guess that the POW camps are probably better than the World War I trenches. The World's Patrick Cox, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
And you can check out Patrick's weekly podcast, The World in Words, at theworld.org/language.
My, don't we sound grown up when we're on the big show? Anyway, more dialects now on wine labels. Yes, strange place for a regional dialect to show up. But maybe like me, you can't really make head or tail of the descriptions of wines as they're represented on those labels. You know, all of that nutty, buttery, oaky talk. Well, there's this chain of British convenience stores. It's called Spar. And Spar is replacing that pretentious talk with more regionally specific pretentious talk, including, you know, regional faux spelling. Here's an example of how a label read before Spar made the changes.
A truly great Merlot, which is ablaze with succulent blackcurrants and blueberries. This wine has legs like a thoroughbred, strong and forward, which tantalizes your palate. Its full bouquet is a delight for your nose and will leave you yearning for more. This isn't a wine for the faint-hearted.
And now a description of the same wine after the introduction of regional dialects. This one is Scottish.
A totally stoughton bevy. It's bricht and full of flavour, with plum currenty fruit, making it taste affy braw. A young'un's colour with cherries and black fruit on the nose. It has a lalder kick to it that runs from the front to the back of your mouth.
Well, I guess you have to give Spar points for originality. And that was what drew us to speak with a representative of the company. Her name is Laura Jewell, and she fielded questions from Katie Clark.
Laura Jewell, do any of us know what it means to be ablaze with succulent black currants and blueberries? I mean, isn't that just making it even more confusing?
I think we're trying to get people to be enthusiastic about the wines, and I think most people will understand the black currants and that it's just full and brimming with them. So, yeah, I think most people would get it in this country.
Who do you think this will appeal to?
This is a bit of research that we've done, and it's meant we've discovered that people find language on back labels quite intimidating, as you've said. So in the middle of redesigning our labels, we decided to listen to our consumers. And that meant that we decided to translate that tasting note into 8 different dialects to reflect the wide geographical range of our customers. So we've done from Scottish in the north all the way to Somerset in the far south. So it's appealing to a wide range of customers to talk to them in their language on a local level.
Who did the translations for you?
We asked people who work in our stores and at our regional wholesalers, so we believe that they're as authentic as we could get them to be.
I'd like to play another local dialect here.
A sweet-smelling red with cherry and vanilla. Oak on nose and a tobacco is a rummin. Listen soft in the gob with a touch of wood. This wine will be right good with this supper, as it gets better and better as it opens in glass. They'll guzzle down this wine and they'll be as happy as a pig in muck.
Happy as a pig in muck. I'm wondering, is that really the kind of association you want made with your wine?
We want people to be enthusiastic about the wines, and that's what we're trying to get across. So I'm perfectly happy with that. It's a great recommendation, and if it appeals to people and makes them smile and takes the stuffiness out of wine, then that's perfect for us.
Is this a bit dangerous territory, though, you're venturing into, maybe seen as a bit patronizing, like people in these parts of the country wouldn't understand the original language on the bottle?
We just want people to have a bit of fun with our wine labelling, and we recognise that there are many different dialects and regional variations on dialects. So we know that they vary from one person to another and from region to region. So it's really just about making our labels more accessible to our customers in general.
Laura Jewell is the wine controller for the Spar convenience stores in Britain. Thanks for your time, Laura.
Thank you very much.
Now, this being a Boston-based podcast, I think you need to hear a wine label done in the local brogue, right? So it's back to that bottle of Merlot that you heard in Scottish. Here it is in a Boston dialect.
A wicked good Merlot with tons of fruit. It's strong as a hoss and explodes in your mouth. It's got this awesome flowery smell, and you don't want to stop drinking it. It's a keeper.
That is the voice of my boss and Mr. Boston through and through, Bob Ferrante. I raise a glass of the best Spar Merlot to you, O fearless leader. Okay, after that mini detour across the pond, it's back to the old world. In this case, very old. In Britain, you might say that history, as taught in the schools, is obsessed with one date above all others. And that is the date when Britain was last invaded and occupied, 1066. That's when the Battle of Hastings took place. The Normans sailed over from Normandy in France and defeated the English Saxons. The victorious William the Conqueror became William the First, and among other things, the English language was changed forever. Now, what if William hadn't won? What if he lost the Battle of Hastings and the Saxons prevailed? What follows is a discussion of this on BBC Radio. You'll hear a lot of talk of we and us, which in this case means Brits, British people, because this is a radio segment that was broadcast on British domestic radio, so most of the listeners, unlike many of you, were Brits. So, here's the BBC's John Humphreys.
If you are forebusied with yearnfully wondering what would have happened if your 16th or 17th eld father had won the Guth of Hastings and what the English tongue would have sounded like, then wonder no more. Through watch against the error world tongues of Greek and Latin and the outlandish Norman speech. You get that?
No, you didn't.
I heard you discuss it in the office earlier, so therefore you know that what we're talking about is Old English and how we might have been speaking. That is how we might have been speaking had the Battle of Hastings gone on, 1066 and all that had ended up rather differently. David Cowley has written a book about it, How We Talk If the English Had Won in 1066, and he's on the line, so is Professor Clive Upton, the head of modern English at the University of Leeds. How did I do with my old English there, David Cowley?
Good morning, John. Yeah, very good, yeah, I was impressed.
Thank you very much. I didn't understand a word of it. Through watch against the error world tongues. That was the bit I liked. It has a ring to it, doesn't it? We've lost a lot, have we?
We certainly did lose a lot in the wake of the Norman conquest. A lot of good old English words fell out of use and were ousted by French and Latin words instead. Yeah.
So was it, Professor Upton, was it a bad thing?
No, we gained a lot as well as we
Did
lost
we?
A lot. And that's what happens with language change.
But English is a Germanic language, isn't it?
It is a Germanic language, yes, and so it works. It worked very much like German does now, with a lot of compounding. But compounding can get out of hand eventually.
You mean adding, sort of adding bits of words together.
That's right. You end up with foot-long words, don't you?
Quite, and you can't remember where you began with it. Yeah, and then to add to that, we've got bits of Latin and French and Anglo-Saxon and all the rest of it. Although that is a Germanic language, of course.
That's right. They all ultimately have the same root. What you get with each of these invasions, and we can start with the Vikings even before the Norman conquest, is new resources which English, being English, has made use of and turned to its own advantage.
And David Cardy, what the Normans did was well, I suppose, bad mouth. I don't know whether that's English or what it is, but
well,
anyway,
it is, yeah.
They demeaned the English language, didn't they? They made a sort of second-class language.
Yes, well, English was the one of the main official languages. Obviously, some Latin was used, but English was a proper official language, and it was ousted in England after that. And we did lose some very useful and expressive words. I'll give you some examples.
Yeah.
There was a word segnes, which would now in new English would be sanus, and that mean expression itself, expression sanus, steerness for guidance, overmuchness. Says its own meaning.
Well, it does sort of. We have what, goodness and sadness.
We
still?
Do. So yeah, these are the same kind of patterns. So we're finding existing patterns were being used, but somehow they died out. Matchness, compatibility, moonly for lunar, sunly for solar, waterly, aquatic,
right,
and wordful, fluent, yearnful. Right. Just has its own thing. What's an unhaver? If something was unbefought, an election had been unbefought, you'd know what it means straight away.
We would just about, wouldn't we? Yeah. So give us a very quick one, Professor Upton. What have we got instead of that sort of, some of those rather lovely old words? What have we got instead?
We've got a whole load of stylistic resource. So we can use English words, but we can use the Latinate words, if you like, as well. So, I mean, we have got fragile, we have got breakable, for example, and they're not quite the same, are they? They're not synonyms.
Exactly. So we've got more tools in our kit, in our linguistic kit, basically.
Exactly so.
Very good. Professor Clive Upton and David Cowley, author of How We Talk If the English Had Won in 1066. Thank you both very much.
Well, that was interesting. I hadn't thought about that at all. I mean, I spent a lot of time, like many others do, thinking about where English came from, where it may be going, but less so on how discrete events, like a battle, may have radically altered its course. Okay, on to a London dialect, a bit of a dying dialect, and that, of course, is Cockney. People from London don't really speak Cockney anymore. There are London accents, plenty of them. But you'd have to say that Cockney has been on the decline for decades. And then there's Cockney rhyming slang. If you don't know what that is, it is the practice of replacing one expression with another that rhymes with the original expression. And that second expression may or may not reflect on the original meaning. So, for example, my wife in the original becomes my trouble and strife. That's a classic. My kids, my dustbin lids, and so on. Cockney slang these days is very much nostalgic kitsch, which is exactly why a British bank has equipped 5 of its ATMs with Cockney rhyming slang. Yep, they talk in rhyming slang. Here's the Big Show's UK correspondent, Laura Lynch.
Now, I like to think I've got a little bit of Cockney blood in me, and here's why. These are the bells of St. Mary Le Bow Church in East London. Tradition holds if you're born within hearing of these bells, you're full-blooded Cockney. Well, my dad may just have heard the bells the day of his birth in his parents' bedroom a few miles away. Never mind, he left Britain when he was 6. So when I heard about Cockney bank machines, I had to investigate. Deep in the heart of the East End, I find the cash machine and a real-life Cockney to translate. Roy Parker is a dispatcher at a taxi company, steps from the machine, and he's eager to lend a hand.
Yeah. I brought my card.
Yeah, if you put your card
in. And I see we've got a limit on the withdrawal, so that's good.
All right. Now, it says select the English or Cockney.
Okay.
So say you're going to use Cockney, right?
Right.
So reading your bladder of lard, which rhymes with card.
Card, yes.
Yeah. Please enter your Huckleberry Finn pin.
Huckleberry Finn is your pin number. Now you know what my Huckleberry Finn is.
Yeah, no, I don't. That Tom Hanks means thanks.
Tom Hanks?
Yeah.
Tom Hanks for thanks. Well, that's got to be modern.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's modern.
Roy is ruddy-faced, barrel-chested, and practically strutting with pride about his heritage and his language. Never mind that it evolved as a kind of coded language for crooked street merchants to keep secrets from the police and unwitting customers. Roy laments what time has done to the dialect.
The real old feeling of Cockneys as such, who were always cheerful and always, hello, me old China plate, how are you? Hello, mate, how are you? You know, it's like you saying, hi, how are you? So it was just another kind of language, really, but it was a language that was understood mainly only by people from the East End.
And not well understood by me. I am too slow, we're talking too much, and the machine decides I've taken way too long.
Oh, my God.
Uh-oh, they just stole my car.
Time has been returned.
Oh. Well, we were a little bit silly about that
one,
weren't we?
A bit of Barney Rubble now.
And what's the Barney Rubble?
Trouble. That's modern.
Not much I can do now, but luckily Gemma Salisbury steps up to withdraw some cash and she lets me watch and learn.
Lady Godiva.
What, lady? Oh, these are the names of the dollars. Lady Godiva.
Fiver.
Lady Godiva. Speckled Hen 10.
And so it goes. The company that created the Cockney machines is trying them out for 3 months. But Roy Parker knows his neighborhood, knows how it's changing. He doubts Cockney is going to catch on with today's crowd.
The way people are moving in this world today, and people are 100 mile an hour, all they want to do is get their money out.
Yeah.
If they see Cockney slang, 8 out of 10 people will say, what's Cockney slang? What's that?
As for me, I may have lost my bank card, but hey, I've gained more than a little Barney Rubble. I'm in touch with my inner Cockney. And in Roy Parker, I've found a new China plate. For the world, I'm Laura Lynch in London.
Well, we're not quite done with Cockney rhyming and otherwise. The next story is about Americans who love England and the English. Anglophiles. This has always perplexed me a bit. Some Brits, and I say some Brits, they are notoriously, I would say shamefully, mean-spirited toward Americans for all kinds of reasons, which I won't get into now. But for some reason, this abuse doesn't put all that many Americans off. They take the punishment and they just go on loving Brits, or at least they go on loving British culture. Now, I know I said I wouldn't get into why I think so many Brits appear to dislike Americans, but I will make one exception because I think it's pertinent here. And that exception is American actors doing bad British accents. And at the very top of the list has to be Dick Van Dyke's magnificently incompetent Cockney accent in Mary Poppins. If you have not seen that movie, it's worth seeing it simply for his rendition of Cockney. It's fabulous. Check this out.
Chim-chimney, chim-chimney, chim-chim-cheree. A sweep is as lucky can be. Chim-chimney, chim-chimney, chim-chim-cheroo. Good luck, we're above when I shake hands with you. Or blow me a kiss. And that's lucky too.
Brilliant. The dialect spoken on Planet Van Dyke.
Life has been strong. You might think a sweep's on the bottom most rung.
Okay, Dick, we're going back to Cockney now. Here's a story I did for college radio. Yes, college radio. It's just about the oldest story of mine that I have. I had to dub it off of cassette. It was a challenge just finding a cassette player around here. I think it's from 1990. You'll hear a reference to Maggie, former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Now, the people in this report are all Americans living in San Francisco with one thing in common. They love spending time in England and hearing how the English talk. Here goes.
Britannia, Britannia, Britannia.
They're warm. They're smashing people.
I love it. England's fantastic.
I've never met an Englishman I didn't like.
I'm taking a class on London history. I like hearing Cockney accents for some reason.
Me and me mates went down to the Axo Cube to avoid me trouble and strife.
Well, this is Cockney rhyming slang. Loaf of bread is your head. The trouble and strife is a wife.
My daisy roots, my boots, my almond rocks, my socks, my rank and riches, me breeches.
My favorite expression, which all my English girlfriends use, is lovely, darling, lovely.
And I know a lot of English people have said that they can't stand hearing Cockney accents because it's so improper and, you know, they don't like it. It makes people sound ignorant because the pronunciation's wrong. It's not the Queen's English.
I was within maybe 3 feet of the Queen. I think she's just incredibly marvelous. I think she's an intelligent woman with a great deal of knowledge.
Well, a lot of the people I worked with on the switchboards talk about how they went out with their boyfriends at night, and their boyfriends were construction workers, and they liked to drink Malibu.
Charles and Diana's wedding.
British police officers are normally unarmed, whereas criminals at least have baseball bats, or cricket bats.
Well, it was just one of those incredible experiences of my lifetime, and they were wonderful seats. I got to see all of the wedding, all of the procession, all of the people. It was just a proper, lovely event.
I don't know a lot about Maggie. I didn't study a lot about her. Seems to me like the Conservatives are still in charge.
My chips and peas, my knees.
English food is not the best.
I think people put it down far too much. Maybe, you know, I just like greasy stuff.
My plates of meat. My feet.
I love chocolate digestives. That's the only thing I brought back from England recently in abundance.
My bacon and eggs. My legs.
We have a very English Christmas. We use roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. Then we add a French dessert.
No nutritional value whatsoever.
A friend called me one Christmas when I had only been in England once, and he said all the lorries were on strike. And I couldn't figure out why that would be a problem until I realized they were trucks and nobody had toilet paper.
Hello, Fred.
The highway system is a bit of a problem.
Come in off the old Frog and Toad and have a cup of Rosie.
To go from one town to another, you could do 13 roundabouts, and you're going north, south, east, and west to get north.
It's only kind and able. But wipe your plates of meat.
Lovely, darling. Lovely.
She's up the apples and pears, having a bow peep. I'm still on the old cob and coal. Get into the lion's lair and let's chew the fat. God. What? That's what it feels like.
Okay, that's it for this week. See you on Facebook or Twitter or theworld.org/language. On next week's pod, I promise we'll leave Britain far, far behind. See you then.
She got a double bunk, double trouble bunk. She really had a hunk of trouble in that bunk. The Navy's not the same, it seems an awful shame. Sleeping like a monk in an empty double bunk. E-R-O-O, chugga, 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 chug.